Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Bert Weisbord, and I'm here to talk with Brendan Kiley about my novel Inside Passage, and more generally to compare the unique culture of Seattle with the singular cultures of Los Angeles and New York City. Brendan's an editor, art critic, book critic, investigative reporter, and jack of all trades at The Stranger, a legendary alternative newspaper and a Seattle institution. I've produced feature films including Ghost Stories starring Fred Astaire and Raggedy Man starring Sissy Spacek. My first novel, Inside Passage, was published in January of this year by Rare Bird Books. My next novel, In Velvet, will also be published by Rare Bird in the spring of 2014. Hello, Brendan.
Hi, Bert. How are you?
Good, good. Why don't we begin by just talking about a quote that sort of leads us into what's unique about Seattle culture. And the quote is, good fences make good neighbors. How do you apply that
right
to Seattle?
Right. I mean, that's an iconic saying, you know, of the American West. And I think in some ways, Seattle as a city distills some of that ethos of the American West. And the idea of good fences make good neighbors means, you know, people are more or less free to do what they want within the small sphere of their own lives without too much interference from the outside world. That is, unless they cause some kind of problem for the community at large. But it really means, you know, you keep the borders up, you keep the boundaries up, you keep the fences up, and I'll respect your right to do whatever the hell you want in your private sphere, with the expectation that you are going to respect me and mine, which for some people can feel a little alienating. People talk about the famous your infamous Seattle freeze, you know, a sense of unfriendliness in Seattle culture. But I think some of that comes from this old idea that people pretty much leave each other alone to do as they see fit.
I mean, the positive side of that is it's very accepting and not very judgmental. On the other hand, and not intrusive. Unlike New York, for example, where people want to know all about you right away. Or Los Angeles, where there's such an influx of new people that there isn't the same sense of, people get to know each other fairly quickly. Whereas in Seattle, my impression has always been that, you know, you have to bake the lemon bars for 2 years before you get to really speak on the committee.
Right. I mean, I'm curious. I mean, maybe we should state our bona fides in the sense of, you know, I've lived in Seattle for several years, lived in Chicago for a while, have visited New York extensively, but never lived there, and not spent a lot of time in Los Angeles. But you've, you know, in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and Seattle, you spent a lot of time in all four cities, right?
Right, right. I did live over 10 years in Los Angeles and over 5 in New York and grew up in Chicago. And, of course, over like 14 years in Seattle or Bainbridge Island.
So I'm curious what you think the difference is, particularly between Los Angeles and Seattle. I mean, New York and Seattle are different coasts. They're obviously different kinds of cases. But L.A. and Seattle are both West Coast cities. And why do you think that sort of gap exists between the cultures of those two towns?
Well, let's use an example here that I think is illustrative. In L.A., people like doing favors for each other. It's sort of the coin of the realm. You know, it's like if you're an agent, and let's talk particularly about the movie business, which I know. If you're an agent, you want to talk about what you've done for this actor or what you've done for this writer or what you've, you know, and that's sort of how you put yourself forward. In Seattle, people don't want people to do favors for them. I mean, you can speak to that. Don't you think that's true?
I do think it's true. I mean, we were talking a little while ago about sort of debt cultures and debt societies and the way social debts get circulated. And I think that it, you know, goes back to that principle of independence and the good fences make good neighbors saying that people want to seem more or less self-reliant. And I've heard you talk about doing, you know, people doing favors for each other and talking about favors in New York and Los Angeles as a kind of badge of honor. Whereas in Seattle, I think in general, I mean, it's a gross oversimplification, obviously, but in general, I think favors tend to be more discreet and secretive because the fact that someone has done a favor for another undercuts the sort of mythos of the rugged, self-reliant individual that maybe is part of the American West ideal.
Well, and it's Scandinavian, too, you know, this kind of fierce independence, not dependent on other people, not needing other people, self-sufficient. And I guess the companion to that, especially in terms of talking about L.A. and New York, is that Seattleites do not like extravagance. All you need to do is sit on the back porch of my office in when I was in the movie business in L.A. and watch the cars that come up for the meetings, you know, the purple Rolls Royce and the, you know, golden Mercedes. And the people like extravagance, at least some people do in those cultures, certainly in New York. I mean, the spending, you know, $1,000 for dinner, including a $500 bottle of wine, is not unusual. Whereas in Seattle, you would never see that unless, you know, someone else was hosting.
No, I've had friends, writers and actors and others who've moved to L.A. and New York, and I've heard multiple times anecdotes of them getting advice from people who've been on the scene in those cities for a while, suggesting that they rent cars to go to meetings or that kind of thing, you know, to show that they're established, they're okay, they don't, you know, they're doing all right. In Seattle, by and large, it'd be fine to show up kind of sweaty with a bike helmet in hand.
I was just going to say, you got to rent the bike. And, you know.
Right.
But, you know, there's another, I think, interesting parallel, particularly with L.A., the movie business. And Seattle is, you know, if you wanted to characterize the big industries, it's really a lot of technology. You know, it's Microsoft, it's Amazon, which, you know. And the thing about technology is that it is, by definition, going forward, what you're looking for is innovation, new ideas. Whereas in the movie business, it's all repetitive. It's what has worked. Let's do, you know, the third sequel. You know, when you go to pitch an idea for a TV show or a movie show, what you want to do is you want to compare it to something that exists. You don't come in and say, no one's ever done anything like this.
And it wasn't always that way, is my understanding, that when you were in Los Angeles, there was a little more premium put on innovation and not how can we replicate the last big thing, but how can we make the next big thing.
No, you make an important point. I think there's been a big change in the culture at large, certainly in the movie business. When I was, you know, at the height of what I consider the golden age of the movie business, which is, you know, 70s, sort of ends with Heaven's Gate, I'd say, in the early 80s. Starts with The Graduate in the late, I guess, at 68. I'm winging this. I may have the years wrong. But it's pretty much a decade of the 70s. And there was a lot of innovation and, you know, but it was partly coming off the French New Wave, and I don't want to digress in the history of the cinema, but you know, the 60s created an atmosphere in which the culture was different and people were experimenting and taking risks that they hadn't taken before, and that sort of ended in the 80s, and the movie business became more, you know, starts, the beginning of the end is probably Star Wars, which I think was the late 70s. And, you know, the movie business starts making movies for kids. They figured out that, you know, kids would go to the movie four times, Star Wars, and suddenly your audience is four times as big. And the toys. And anyhow, you've now, most big movies, tentpoles, as they call them, are geared toward a younger audience. And there are exceptions, of course. But, I mean, and again, it's grossly oversimplified, but there is a sort of pride in Seattle about doing things differently and being, and even to the extent that, you know, a lot of people present themselves as more eccentric than they are.
That's a feature of Seattle culture, I think. Eccentricity can be cultivated here more so than
and
other
it's,
places.
And it's prized. Whereas, you know, in the movie business, of course, if you are very, very successful, you can do whatever you want. But until you get there, you've got to be a little, I mean, you know, at least now, you present yourself in more conventional ways.
Well, I think that the goes other... to what you were talking about in terms... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it goes back to what you were talking about in terms of the businesses that are identified with this area in terms of technology, in terms of innovation, and which kind of goes back to the thing we were first talking about in terms of good fences make good neighbors and independence. The idea is that within the sphere that you operate, doing things differently, doing things in an innovative way, is prized, and you know, conforming to what has been successful in the past is not, I wouldn't say scorned, but it's not seen generally as the roadmap to great success.
Certainly not at places like Microsoft or Amazon or any of the other biotech companies that are flourishing in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I would add another thing that clearly is different in New York and L.A. than Seattle, and that's just real estate prices. And I think that's formative. I mean, I think that, you know, the fact that certainly Manhattan is off the charts, but it makes Manhattan more, and I guess there's a related factor here that drives real estate prices up, is that Manhattan's more of an international destination, as is L.A. I mean, a lot of people have apartments in Manhattan who don't live here, but want to have a toehold here.
Right.
And it makes the demand extremely high for every inch of Seattle real estate. Whereas in Seattle, you can still live, you know, like in the International District, very close to the center of things at affordable prices.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole other interesting phenomenon when you're talking about Manhattan and you're talking about cultures. You know, there's a sense of, I think that Manhattan has concentrated a kind of culture that is international, but is of a similar or roughly similar economic background. And so in that sense, you have sort of a world culture of people who are, you know, wealthy enough to be able to afford some of those fancy places on the Upper East Side and Upper West Side. That is, you know, this seems substantially different than the culture of the surrounding boroughs. And there isn't a part of Seattle that is like that in any way. It's much more mixed. Obviously, there are wealthier places and not so wealthy places, but the lines between them, I think, are a lot more blurred than they are in a place like Manhattan, or I would imagine some neighborhoods in Los Angeles as well.
Yeah, no, there's the whole west side of Los Angeles, you know, Santa Monica, Brentwood, Beverly Hills. I mean, you know, that's expensive real estate, Malibu. But there are other outlying areas that are not so expensive, certainly downtown. And but I want to come back to Inside Passage because I want to relate sort of the Seattle location. And I guess the other thing that is we haven't talked about that's so important for Inside Passage is the difference in the physical landscape of Seattle from either New York City or L.A. I mean, just the very connectedness to the wilderness in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's more so in L.A. I mean, you can go into the hills beyond Malibu, and there is, you know, relatively wild country. But it's not at all like getting on a boat and going up the Inside Passage from Seattle, which is very accessible and truly wild.
Well, and you've pointed out before that the heroine in your novel, Corey Logan, when she gets in trouble, what she does is hop in a boat and you know, flee into the islands, into the Inside Passage, to hide out, which is something, you know, that you can't do in the same way in other cities. And the other thing is also just the wildness of it is quite immediate in Seattle, because even if you're downtown and you fall into the water in the winter, like, hypothermia is a very real possibility if you're falling off a ferry or whatever, and you can be, you know, within sight of downtown and still die.
That's right.
real possibility at all times.
And people growing up there are very aware of it. And, you know, I guess the other thing about Corey Logan is that she's poor. She has no money, but she has this very rich life in wild country. I mean, she knows her way around, and there is this part of the character Northwesterners, not just Seattleites, which is they're pretty able and wild country, and they enjoy it. They know how to, I mean, you know, people go camping, and they, you know, if you're in downtown Seattle, you can see, you know, the Olympic Mountains. You can see all the islands in Puget Sound. There's a lot of wild places to explore.
Yeah, I had it reminds me of a somewhat funny encounter I had a couple of years ago with the artistic director of Pacific Northwest Ballet, Peter Bull, who was a, you know, very renowned dancer in New York, and with Balanchine and his successors. And he moved to Seattle a few years ago to be the artistic director of Pacific Northwest Ballet. And I saw him on a ferry to Bainbridge once, shortly after he'd moved to the area. And he had, you know, a new fleece sort of vest on that looked like it was right off the rack. And he had his two little sons with him. And I asked him where he was going. And he said, well, I've moved to the Northwest, so I suppose I should go camping. You know, he was right out to the peninsula with the kids. And he was this, you know, this celebrity in ballet and dance culture in New York City. And he looked a little uncomfortable as he was contemplating going camping for the first time. But he felt like it was a duty now that he'd moved to Seattle.
He was right.
He was
right.
Trying to fit in.
Well, I got to tell you, you can always tell the people who are from the Northwest at the boat ramps.
How so?
You know, and I. Well, they know how to back their trailers down and get the boats in the water.
You mean when you're in New York or other cities?
No, when you come from New York, or in my case, from L.A., I had to learn how to back, you know, had a boat, a little one, you know, fishing boat. And I had to learn how to, you know, handle it at the boat ramp. Took a little doing. You know, thinking about
the
tides.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, there is pride in knowing how to fish and knowing how to camp and knowing, you know, having some means at your house to purify water, whether it's a pump or iodine tablets, and, you know, having handy knives and tools. These are seen as pretty, I think for most people, pretty basic parts of any household.
Well, and I also think that, I mean, in Inside Passage, you know, Abe is kind of, although it's not developed, he is much more of a Northeasterner than a Northwesterner. And he sort of lives in his mind, and he's very psychologically aware. And that's something we ought to talk about. I mean, Seattleites are not that interested in, they're not as self-aware as a lot of Easterners or Los Angelinos. It's not part of the culture in the same way to be. I mean, it's more part of the culture to go for a hike if you're not feeling good, or chop wood. Am I stating this clearly?
I think so. I mean, it's you would know better than I would, having given all the time you've spent in these different cities. But I wonder, is it a matter of less self-aware or less expressive? And that's a real question for me. I don't know.
Well, you can't generalize, because, of course, there are many Seattleites who are very self-aware. But I think there's less interest in it, so there's less focus on it. I mean, it's not. There are a lot of conversations in New York where the central goal is insight. And, I mean, people really are focused on understanding why somebody is like he is or she is. Mm-hmm. And I think there's less of that in Seattle. It's much more descriptive, much more, you know, interested in how things work rather than the inner workings of emotional life.
That makes sense. That makes sense to me. Yeah. And that can be manipulated as well. I mean, there are characters in your novel who take advantage of that and of the capacity that good fences make good neighbors kind of principle in a very calculated way to take advantage of people in situations, right?
Next season is like that.
Right. And he comes to Seattle to reinvent himself in a way that may not have been quite as possible in a more sort of intrusive or investigative kind of culture.
Yeah, you have to ask yourself if he'd been running for you know, public office in L.A. or New York, whether they would have asked tougher questions about his past.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the Seattle press can be very good, but the, just the style is less confrontational.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's true, yeah, by and large. Not always. And it's funny to see how the city changes as well. I mean, it's maybe harder for me to see because I've lived here for so long. But it does seem like, well, in the way that Los Angeles, you say, has changed in the last 10 years, I think that, that Seattle is undergoing some changes as well. But these issues that we talk about, sort of the bedrock of the way people operate, I think are still certainly applicable.
Well, this is something that I'd be interested in your take on as a reporter, because as a reporter, you frequent. I mean, Seattleites are notoriously conflict avoidant,
mm-hmm.
and as a reporter, you have to be confrontational frequently. I'm sure. I mean, you have to push people
yeah,
places
sure.
they don't. And how do you think about that? And how do you? I mean, is it a plus or a minus in terms of the work that you do?
Well, it depends on who you're confronting. Some people, it's a real pleasure to push them where they don't want to go. And some people, you feel kind of badly about it. I think that I have a little more of an advantage because of where I work, because the Stranger is known as a pretty confrontational place. You know, our editor, executive editor, and the editor for many years, one of the founders, Dan Savage, the sex advice columnist and gay rights activist, who is known nationally and in some places even internationally for being confrontational about stuff. And that's sort of the culture here. So when I call someone and say, I'm Brendan Kiley from The Stranger, if they are familiar with the paper, they, I imagine, are expecting at least the possibility of a somewhat confrontational encounter. But yeah, I mean, some people do get really flustered by it. And even things that I wouldn't consider confrontational, you know, just simple, straightforward questions in a normal tone of voice. Sometimes people start sputtering and getting weirded out because they're not used to being, you know, directly questioned about this or that subject, which might be not entirely comfortable for them. So that certainly, you can certainly sense the discomfort in people sometimes. And sometimes they just get mad, you know, and sometimes they roll with it pretty well. But I certainly, you know, I call people all around the country, depending on the story. And I do get a sense that when talking to Northwesterners, they're maybe a little more sensitive about the direct questioning approach to things.
Certainly in New York, it's part of public life. And I'm sure in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
too. I mean, you know, you just expect to be asked all the tough questions and you think about how you're going to deal with them. But let's go back to Dan Savage, because I think it's a wonderful example of what is, you know, he is absolutely outside of the mold, but I don't know if
mm-hmm.
he could have done what he did anyplace else.
Well, that's, I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's interesting. I mean, he grew up in Chicago as well and came to Seattle when he was fairly young. What about him do you think could not have flourished in quite the same way in a different city?
I think that he sort of had space to develop. I mean, he's out at the time was like so off the charts in what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
He was so smart and did
mm-hmm.
it so well that it came to be read by kids in school. I mean,
really? I didn't know that.
Well, but it was in the kids at the Northwest School were picking up copies of The Stranger and reading Dan Sandwich.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that was their sex ed class, really. I think for
right.
a lot of people.
Yeah, and but I mean, it's like they left him alone. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that wouldn't have been. That would have happened elsewhere. I can't say. Of course, he probably would have been hugely successful wherever he was because he's so good. But I do remember when my kids were growing up that it was completely, you know, nobody ever raised a question about them picking up The Stranger, which I think at the time was free. Is that right?
Oh, it still is. Yeah, it's always been a free publication.
And, you know, they come home with it and they're talking about they're 12 years old.
Well, it's true that I think when Dan and the paper in general became figured more prominently on the radar screen than just, you know, the Seattle audience that it originally was founded to address, when it got bigger on the radar screen, people, the first thing they would always say is, oh, it uses profanity, oh, it does this, oh, it does that, and without really discussing the content so much, but there was this sense of finger wagging because it was quote-unquote irreverent or quote-unquote edgy. And you did see people in other cities, that was their first reaction to it, was they were surprised that a paper like that could exist at all. And then eventually people got over that and started talking more about what the issues were, what the content was. But maybe that does speak to something that is a little bit different about Seattle that would allow a paper like The Stranger to grow enough to begin to have resonance beyond the borders of the city, and how that surprised people in other cities.
You know, I think it's a great virtue about Seattle, and I think that, I mean, maybe we should tell listeners a little more about Dan Savage. I'm not sure everybody is as familiar with him as Seattleites are. Could you go over the history a little bit? And
Sure. He, I believe, was one of the co-founders of the paper, of The Stranger, that was also co-founded by Tim Keck, who I believe is one of the founders of The Onion, when he was in college out in the Midwest, where he and Dan met. But they moved out to Seattle. They started The Stranger. Dan started as a sex advice columnist with a column called Savage Love that was, again, confrontational. He's a gay man, and he was very self-assured when giving sex advice to heterosexuals and sometimes a quasi-abusive tone, but it was great. Both for gay people and for straight people to encounter.
Well,
that
and
kind
he was
of frank
way ahead
talk.
In terms of he was way ahead of everybody in terms of both his frankness and he was very psychologically aware, is my memory, and
yeah.
very you know medically sophisticated. I mean, he did his homework.
Yeah, and the several physicians that he regularly consults. That are friends or spouses of friends. But, excuse me, yeah, the column Savage Love became syndicated to a lot of different papers around the country. And most recently, I think Dan is known for the It Gets Better project, which really began as a small little YouTube video and snowballed. But the basic premise was to tell young people, especially in middle school and in high school, who are gay, who are find themselves in family or school situations that are really somewhat oppressive, to tell them, you know, because there's a rash of suicides in the past few years of gay teenagers, but to tell them that just hang on, wait, it will get better, you'll grow up, you'll be an adult, you can live your life the way that you choose. So it was an anti-suicide campaign that really, really got legs.
Well, and I think that he was sort of universally respected among young people in Seattle, which is very hard to do. People really relied on his advice and talked openly about it. So that really sort of, I think, is also a uniquely Seattle phenomenon, that the way in which he was nurtured by the city in a way by not being intrusive, and he really was able to develop a whole body of work. And when people became familiar with the body of work, they were very respectful of him. I mean, I think he has great stature way beyond the, young people, but certainly with young people.
I think that's true, and I think, you know, we're talking about Seattle and cultivating innovators in terms of the tech business, but I think that the city nurtures and cultivates innovators in other spheres as well, and I think Dan is a great example of a person who was allowed to and encouraged to innovate in a way that nobody else was doing, not only in the city, but not really in the country either, which is what makes him so unique as one of those Seattle figures.
And I think that, you know, we got to give credit where credit's due. The Stranger really backed him. And
yeah,
Stranger,
he's the editor here for several years.
What is his relationship to the paper now?
He is technically the executive editor, which is a vague kind of term. But, you know, he's around, and he's still writing for the paper regularly, still writing the column, obviously, and writing other stuff. And I think executive editor means you can give anyone advice at any time, whether they want it or not. I think that's technically what the definition is.
Well, I'd like to sort of circle back to the book. Only you and I could talk about New York, Seattle, and L.A. and end up on Dan Savage. I think that's appropriate. But I'd like to encourage people to buy Inside Passage, and they can get it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. They can go to www.bertweisbord.com and learn more about the whole trilogy, or they can go to Rare Bird Books and see the page there. And I think it really is a Seattle Northwest story, and a lot of the themes that we've been talking about you can connect to what I did in the book. And Brendan, as always, it's really a pleasure talking about these things with you, and I hope to do it again soon.
A pleasure talking to you. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, Brendan, we'll talk soon. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.